given to diffident movements of hand brushing flaxen hair from front of dear creamy forehead, movements which drove Bruce Green up a private tree. A vision in a sundress and silly shoes. Mildred L. Bonk. And then, but by 10th grade, in one of those queer, when did that happen metamorphoses, Mildred Bonk had become an imposing member of the frightening Winchester High School set that smoked full-strength Marlboros in the alley between senior and junior halls and that left school altogether at lunchtime, driving away in loud, low-slung cars to drink beer and smoke dope, driving around with sound systems of illegal wattage, using Visine and Clorette, etc. She was one of them. She chewed gum, or worse, in the cafeteria. Her dear, diffident face now a bored mask of attitude. Her flaxen locks now teased and gelled into what looked, for all the world, like the consequence of a finger stuck into an electric socket. Bruce Green saved up for a low-slung old car and practiced attitude on the aunt who'd taken him in. He developed a will. And by the year of what would have been graduation, Bruce Green was way more bored, imposing, and frightening than even Mildred Bonk. And he and Mildred Bonk and tiny, incontinent Harriet Bonk Green lived just off the Alston Spur in a shiny house trailer with another frightening couple and with Tommy Ducey, the infamous hair-lipped pot and sundries dealer who kept several large snakes in unclean, uncovered aquaria, which smelled, which Tommy Ducey didn't notice because his upper lip completely covered his nostrils, and all he could smell was lip. Mildred Bonk got high in the afternoon and watched cereal cartridges, and Bruce Green had a steady job at Leisure Time Ice. And for a while, life was more or less one big party. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Hal? Hey, Hal. Yes, Mario? Are you asleep? Boo-boo, we've been over this. I can't be asleep if we're talking.
That's what I thought.
Happy to reassure you.
Boy, were you on today. Boy, did you ever make that guy look sick. When he hit that one down the line and you got it and fell down and hit that drop volley.
Pamela said the guy looked like he was going to be sick all over the net, he said. Boo, I kicked that kid's ass is all. End of story. I don't think it's good to rehash it when I've kicked somebody's ass.
It's like a dignity thing.
I think we should just let it sort of lie in state, quietly. Speaking of which... Hey, Hal? Hey, Hal? It's late, Mario. It's sleepy time. Close your eyes and think fuzzy thoughts.
That's what the moms always says, too.
Always work for me, boo.
You think I think fuzzy thoughts all the time. You let me room with you because you feel sorry for me.
Boo-boo, I'm not even going to dignify that. I'll regard it as, like, a warning sign. You always get petulant when you don't get enough sleep. And here we are seeing petulance already on the western horizon, right here.
When I asked if you were asleep, I was going to ask if you felt like you believed in God today out there when you were so on, making that guy look sick.
This again? Really don't think midnight in a totally dark room with me so tired my hair hurts and drills in 6 short hours is the time and place to get into this, Mario.
You ask me this once a week.
You never say is why.
So tonight, to shush you, how about if I say, I have administrative bones to pick with God, boo. I'll say God seems to have a kind of laid-back management style I'm not crazy about. I'm pretty much anti-death. God looks, by all accounts, to be pro-death.
I'm not seeing how we can get together on this issue, he and I, boo.
You're talking about since himself passed away. See? You never say.
I do too say. I just did. I just didn't happen to say what you wanted to hear, boo-boo, is all. There's a difference.
I don't get how you couldn't feel like you believed today out there. It was so right there.
You moved like you totally believed. How do you feel inside not?
Mario, you and I are mysterious to each other.
We countenance each other from either side of some unbridgeable difference on this issue. Let's lie very quietly and ponder this.
Hal? Hey, Hal.
I'm going to propose that I tell you a joke, Boo, on the condition that afterward you shush and let me sleep.
Is it a good one?
Mario, what do you get when you cross an insomniac, an unwilling agnostic, and a dyslexic?
I give.
You get somebody who stays up all night torturing himself mentally over the question of whether or not there's a dog.
Huh. That's a good one.
Shush.
Hey, Hal, what's an insomniac?
Somebody who rooms with you, kid, that's for sure.
Hey, Hal, how come the moms never cried when himself passed away? I cried. And you, even CT cried. I saw him personally cry.
You listened to Tosco over and over and cried and said you were sad. We all were. Hey, Hal, did the mom seem like she got happier after himself passed away to you? It seems like she got happier. She seems even taller. She stopped traveling everywhere all the time for this and that thing, the corporate grammar thing, the library protest thing. Now she never goes anywhere, Boo. Now she's got the headmaster's house and her office and the tunnel in between and never leaves the grounds.
She's a worse workaholic than she ever was, and more obsessive compulsive. When's the last time you saw a dust mote in that house?
Hey, Hal.
Now she's just an agoraphobic workaholic and obsessive compulsive. This strikes you as happification?
Her eyes are better. They don't seem as sunk in. They look better. She laughs at CT way more than she laughed at himself. She laughs from lower down inside. She laughs more. Her jokes she tells are better ones than yours even now, a lot of the time. How come she never got sad?
She did get sad, Boo-Boo. She just got sad in her way instead of yours and mine. She got sad, I'm pretty sure.
Hal?
You remember how the staff lowered the flag to half-mast out in front of the portcullis here after it happened? Do you remember that? And it goes to half-mast every year at convocation? Remember the flag, Boo?
Hey, Hal?
Don't cry, Boo-Boo. Remember the flag only halfway up the pole? Boo-Boo, there are two ways to lower a flag to half-mast. Are you listening? Because no shit, I really have to sleep here in a second, so listen. One way to lower the flag to half-mast is just to lower the flag. There's another way, though. You can also just raise the pole. You can raise the pole to like twice its original height. You get me? You understand what I mean, Mario?
Hal.
She's plenty sad, I bet. At 2010 hours, on the 1st of April, YDAU, the medical attaché is still watching the unlabeled entertainment cartridge. October, year of the Depend adult undergarment. For Orin in Candenza, number 71, morning is the soul's night, the day's worst time, psychically. He cranks the condo's AC way down at night and still most mornings wakes up soaked, fetally curled, entombed in that kind of psychic darkness where you're dreading whatever you think of. Hal Incandenza's brother Orin wakes up alone at 0730 hours amid a damp scent of ambush, and on the other side's dented pillow a note with a phone number and vital data in a loopy schoolgirlish hand. There's also ambush on the note. His side of the bed is soaked. Orin makes honey toast, standing barefoot at the kitchen counter wearing briefs and an old academy sweatshirt with the arms cut off, squeezing honey from the head of a plastic bear. The floor so cold it hurts his feet, but the double-pane window over the sink is hot to the touch. The beastly Metro Phoenix October AM heat just outside. Home with the team, no matter how high the AC or how thin the sheet, Oren wakes with his own impressions sweated darkly into the bed beneath him, slowly drying all day to a white, salty outline, just slightly off from the week's other, faint, dried outlines. So his fetal-shaped, fossilized image is fanned out across his side of the bed like a deck of cards, just overlapping, like an acid trail or timed exposure. The heat just past the glass doors tightens his scalp. He takes breakfast out to a white iron table by the condo complex's central pool and tries to eat it there, in the heat, the coffee not steaming or cooling. He sits there in dumb animal pain. He has a mustache of sweat. A bright beach ball floats and bumps against one side of the pool. The sun, like a sneaky keyhole view of hell. No one else out here. The complex is a ring with a pool and deck and jacuzzi in the center. Heat shimmers off the deck like fumes from fuel. There's that mirage thing where the extreme heat makes the dry deck look wet with fuel. Oren can hear cartridge viewers going from behind closed windows, that aerobics show every morning, and also someone playing an organ, and the older woman who won't ever smile back at him in the apartment next to his doing operatic scales, muffled by drapes and sun curtains and double panes. The jacuzzi chugs and foams. The note from last night's subject is on violet bond, once folded, and with a circle of darker violet dead center where the subject's perfume spritzer had hit it. The only interesting thing about the script, but also depressing, is that every single circle, O's, D's, P's, and numbers 6 and 8, is darkened in, while the eyes are dotted not with circles, but with tiny little Valentine hearts, which are not darkened in. Oren reads the note while he eats toast. That's mainly an excuse for the honey. He uses his smaller right arm to eat and drink. His oversized left arm and big left leg remain at rest at all times in the morning. A breeze sends the beach ball skating all the way across the blue pool to the other side, and Oren watches its noiseless glide. The white iron tables have no umbrellas, and you can tell where the sun is without looking. You can feel right where it is on your body and project from there. The ball moves tentatively back out toward the middle of the pool and then stays there, not even bobbing. The same small breezes make the rotted palms along the condominium complex's stone walls rustle and click, and a couple of fronds detach and spiral down, hitting the deck with a slap. All the plants out here are malevolent, heavy, and sharp. The parts of the palms above the fronds are tufted in sick stuff like coconut hair. Roaches and other things live in the trees. Rats, maybe. Loathsome high-altitude critters of all kinds. All the plants either spiny or meaty. Cacti in queer, tortured shapes. The tops of the palms like Rod Stewart's hair from days gone by. Oren returned with the team from the Chicago game 2 nights ago, Red Eye. He knows that he and the place kicker are the only two starters who are not still in terrible pain, physically, from the beating. The day before they left, so like 5 days ago, Oren was out by himself in the jacuzzi by the pool late in the day, caring for the leg, sitting in the radiant heat and bloody late-day light with the leg in the jacuzzi, absently squeezing the tennis ball he still absently squeezes out of habit, watching the jacuzzi funnel and bubble and foam around the leg. And out of nowhere, a bird had all of a sudden fallen into the jacuzzi with a flat, matter-of-fact plop out of nowhere, out of the wide, empty sky. Nothing overhung the jacuzzi but sky. The bird seemed to have just had a coronary or something in flight and died and fallen out of the empty sky and landed dead in the jacuzzi, right by the leg. He brought his sunglasses down onto the bridge of his nose with a finger and looked at it. It was an undistinguished kind of bird. Not a predator. Like a wren, maybe.
It seems like no way could it have been a good sign.
The dead bird bobbed, and Beryl rolled in the foam, sucked under 1 second, and reappearing the next, creating an illusion of continued flight. Oren had inherited none of the mom's phobias about disorder, hygiene. Not crazy about bugs, though. Roaches. But he just sat there squeezing the ball, looking at the bird without a conscious thought in his head. By the next morning, waking up, curled and entombed, it seemed like it had to have been a bad sign, though. Oren now always gets the shower so hot it's to where he can just barely stand it. The condo's whole bathroom is done in this kind of minty yellow tile he didn't choose,
maybe chosen by the free safety who lived here before the Cardinals sent New Orleans the free safety, 2 reserve guards and cash for Oren Incandenza, punter.
And no matter how many times he has the Terminex people out, there are still the enormous roaches that come out of the bathroom drains. Sewer roaches, according to Terminex. Blataria implacablus, or something. Really huge roaches. Armored vehicle-type bugs. Totally black with Kevlar-type cases. The works. And fearless. Raised in the Hobbesian sewers down there. Boston's and New Orleans' little brown roaches were bad enough, but you could at least come in and turn on the light and they'd run for their lives. These Southwest sewer roaches, you turn on the light, and they just look up at you from the tile like, "You got a problem?" Oren stomped on one of them, only once, that had come up hellishly out of the drain in the shower when he was in there, showering, going out naked and putting shoes on and coming in and trying to conventionally squash it, and the result was explosive. There's still material from that one time in the tile grouting. It seems unremovable. Roach innards. Sickening. Throwing the shoes away is preferable to looking at the sole to clean it. Now, he keeps big glass tumblers in the bathroom, and when he turns on the light and sees a roach, he puts a glass down over it, trapping it. After a couple of days, the glass is all steamed up and the roach has asphyxiated, messlessly. And Oren discards both the roach and the tumbler in separate sealed ziplocks in the dumpster complex by the golf course up the street. The yellow tile floor of the bathroom is sometimes a little obstacle course of glasses with huge roaches dying inside, stoically, just sitting there, the glasses gradually steaming up with roach dioxide. The whole thing makes Oren sick. Now he figures the hotter the shower's water, the less chance any small armored vehicle is going to feel like coming out of the drain while he's in there. Sometimes they're in the bowl of the toilet first thing in the AM, dog paddling, trying to get to the side and climb up. He's also not crazy about spiders, though more like unconsciously. He's never come anyplace close to the conscious horror himself had somehow developed about the Southwest's black widows and their chaotic webs.
The widows are all over the place, both here and Tucson.
Spottable on all but the coldest nights, their dusty webs without any kind of pattern, plotting just about any right-angled place that's dim or out of the way. Terminex's toxins are more effective on the widows. Oren has them out monthly. He's on like a subscription plan over at Terminex. Oren's special conscious horror, besides heights and the early morning, is roaches.
There had been parts of Metro Boston near the bay he'd refused to go to as a child.
Roaches give him the howling fantods. The parishes around N.O. had been having a spate or outbreak of a certain Latin origin breed of sinister tropical flying roaches that were small and timid but could fucking fly. And that kept being found swarming on New Orleans infants at night, in their cribs, especially infants in, like, tenements or squalor, and that reportedly fed on the mucus in the baby's eyes, some special sort of optical mucus, the stuff of fucking nightmares, mobile flying roaches that wanted to get at your eyes as an infant, and were reportedly blinding them. Parents had come in the ghastly AM tenement light and find their infants blind. Like a dozen blinded infants that last summer. and it was during this spate or nightmarish outbreak, plus July flooding that sent over a dozen nightmarish dead bodies from a hilltop graveyard, sliding all gray-blue down the incline. Oren and two teammates had their townhouse on, in suburban Chalmette, shedding limbs and innards all the way down the hillside's mud, and one morning coming to rest against the post of their roadside mailbox when Oren came out for the morning paper, that Oren had had his agent put out the trade feelers. And so, to the glass canyons and merciless light of Metro Phoenix, in a kind of desiccated circle, near the Tucson of his own father's desiccated youth. It's the mornings after the spider and heights dreams that are the most painful, that it takes sometimes 3 coffees and 2 showers and sometimes a run to loosen the grip on his soul's throat. And these post-dream mornings are even worse if he wakes up unalone, if the previous night's subject is still there, wanting to twitter or to cuddle and like spoon, asking what exactly is the story with the foggy inverted tumblers on the bathroom floor, commenting on his night sweats, clattering around in the kitchen, making kippers or bacon or something even more hideous and unhoneyed he's supposed to eat with post-coital male gusto. The ones who have this thing about, they call it, feeding my man, wanting a man who can barely keep down AM honey toast to eat with male gusto, elbows out and shoveling, making little noises. Even when alone, able to uncurl alone and sit up slowly and wring out the sheet and go to the bathroom, these darkest mornings start days that Oren can't even bring himself for hours to think about how he'll get through the day. These worst mornings with cold floors and hot windows and merciless light, the soul's certainty that the day will have to be not traversed but sort of climbed vertically, and then that going to sleep again at the end of it will be like falling again off something tall and sheer. So, now his own eye mucus is secure in the desert southwest, but the bad dreams have gotten worse since the trade to this blasted area himself had fled long ago as an unhappy youngster. As a nod to Oren's own unhappy youth, all the dreams seem to open briefly with some sort of competitive tennis situation. Last night's, it started with a wide-angle shot of Oren on a hard-true court, waiting to receive serve from someone vague, some academy person. Ross Reet, maybe, or good old M. Bain, or gray-toothed Walt Fletchett, now a teaching pro in the Carolinas. When the dream's screen tightens on him and abruptly dissolves to the blank dark rose color of eyes closed against bright light, and there's the ghastly feeling of being submerged and not knowing which way to head for the surface and air, and after some interval the dreams Oren struggles up from this kind of visual suffocation to find his mother's head, Mrs. Avril M. T. Incandenses, the mom's disconnected head, attached face to face to his own fine head, strapped tight to his face somehow by a wraparound system of VS, high-pro, top-shelf, lamb-gut string from his academy racket's own face, so that no matter how frantically Oren tries to move his head or shake it side to side or twist up his face or roll his eyes, he's still staring at, into, and somehow through his mother's face. As if the mom's head was some sort of overtight helmet Oren can't wrestle his way out of.
2.
In the dream, it's understandably vital to Oren that he disengage his head from this phylactery-ish bind of his mother's disembodied head, and he cannot. Last night's subject's note indicates that at some point last night, Oren had clutched her head with both hands and tried to sort of stiff-arm her, though not in an ungentle or complaining way. The note, not the stiff arm. The apparent amputation of Mom's head from the rest of the mom's appears in the dream to be clean and surgically neat. There is no evidence of a stump or any kind of nubbin of neck, even, and it is as if the base of the round, pretty head had been sealed and also sort of rounded off so that her head is a large living ball, a globe with a face attached to his own head's face. The subject after Bane's sister, but before the one just before this one, with the ambush scent and the hearts over eyes, The previous subject had been a sallowly pretty Arizona State developmental psychology grad student with two kids and outrageous alimony and penchants for sharp jewelry, refrigerated chocolate, interlace educational cartridges, and professional athletes who thrashed in their sleep.
Not real bright. She thought the figure he'd trace without thinking on her bare flank after sex was the numeral 8, to give you an idea.
Their last morning together, right before he'd mailed her child an expensive toy and then had his phone number changed, he'd awakened from a night of horror show dreams, woke up with an abrupt fetal spasm, unrefreshed and benighted of soul, his eyes wobbling and his wet silhouette on the bottom sheet like a coroner's chalk outline. He woke to find the subject up and sitting up against the reading pillow, wearing his sleeveless Academy sweatshirt and sipping hazelnut espresso and watching, on the cartridge viewing system that occupied half the bedroom's south wall, something horrific called Interlace Educational Cartridges in conjunction with CBC Educational Programming Matrix presents Schizophrenia, Mind or Body. And it had to lie there, moist and paralyzed, curled fetal on his own sweat shadow, and watch on the viewer, a pale young guy about Hal's age, with copper stubble and a red cowlick and flat, blank, affectless black doll's eyes, stare into space stage left, while a brisk Albertan voiceover explained that Fenton here was a dyed-in-the-wool paranoid schizophrenic who believed that radioactive fluids were invading his skull and that hugely complex high-tech type machines had been specially designed and programmed to pursue him without cease until they caught him and made brutal sport of him and buried him alive. It was an old, late-millennial CBC public interest Canadian news documentary,
digitally sharpened and re-disseminated under the Interlace imprimatur. Interlace could get kind of seedy and low rent during early morning off hours in terms of spontaneous disseminations.
And so, but since the old CBC documentary's thesis was turning out pretty clearly to be schizophrenia body, the voiceover evinced great clipped good cheer as it explained that, well, yes, poor old Fenton here was more or less hopeless as an extra-institutional functioning unit, but that on the upside, science could at least give his existence some sort of meaning by studying him very carefully to help learn how schizophrenia manifested itself in the human body's brain. That, in other words, with the aid of cutting-edge positron emission tomography, or PET technology, since supplanted wholly by invasive digitals, Orin hears the developmental psychology graduate student mutter to herself, watching rapt over her cup, unaware that Orin's paralytically awake,
they could scan and study how different parts of poor old Fenton's dysfunctional brain emitted positrons in a whole different topography than your average hale and hearty, non-delusional, God-fearing Albertan's brain.
Advancing science by injecting test subject Fenton here with a special blood-brain barrier-penetrating radioactive dye and then sticking him in the rotating body-sized receptacle of a PET scanner. On the viewer, it's an enormous gray metal machine that looks like something co-designed by James Cameron and Fritz Lang. And now have a look at this Fenton fellow's eyes as he starts to get the gist of what the voiceover is saying. And in a terse old public TV cut, they now showed subject Fenton in 5-point canvas restraints, whipping his copper-haired head from side to side as guys in mint green surgical masks and caps inject him with radioactive fluids through a turkey baster-sized syringe. Then, good old Fenton's eyes bugging out in total foreseen horror as he's rolled toward the huge gray PET device and slid like an unrisen loaf into the thing's open maw until only his decay-colored sneakers are in view. And the body-sized receptacle rotates the test subject counterclockwise with brutal speed so that the old sneakers point up and then left and then down and then right and then up faster and faster. The machine's blurps and tweets not even coming close to covering Fenton's entombed howls as his worst delusional fears came true in digital stereo, and you could hear the last surviving bits of his functional, dye-permeated mind being screamed out of him for all time as the viewer digitally superimposed an image of Fenton's ember-red and neutron-blue brain in the lower right corner. where Interlace's time-temp functions usually appear, and the brisk voiceover gave capsule histories of first paranoid schizophrenia, and then PET. With Orin lying there, slit-eyed, wet and neuralgic, with AM dread, wishing the subject would put her own clothes and sharp jewelry on and take the rest of her Toblerone out of the freezer and go, so he could go to the bathroom and get yesterday's asphyxiated roaches into an EWD dumpster before the dumpster's all filled for the day, and decide what kind of expensive present to mail the subject's kid. And then, the matter of the dead bird, out of nowhere. And then, news of pressure from the AZ Cardinal Administration to cooperate with some sort of insipid-type personality profile series of interviews with some profiler from Moment Magazine, with personal backgroundish questions to be answered in some blandly sincere team PR way, the unexamined stress of which drives him to start calling Haley again. Reopen that whole Pandora's box of worms. Orin also shaves in the shower. Face red with heat, wreathed in steam, by feel, shaving upward with south to north strokes as he was taught. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Here's Hal in Condensa, age 17, with his little brass one-hitter, getting covertly high in the Enfield Tennis Academy's underground pump room and exhaling palely into an industrial exhaust fan. It's the sad little interval after afternoon matches and conditioning, but before the academy's communal supper. Hal is by himself down here, and nobody knows where he is or what he's doing. Hal likes to get high in secret, but a bigger secret is that he's as attached to the secrecy as he is to getting high. A one-hitter, sort of like a long FDR-type cigarette holder whose end is packed with a pinch of good dope, gets hot and is hard on the mouth, the brass ones especially. But one-hitters have the advantage of efficiency. Every particle of ignited pot gets inhaled. There's none of the incidental second-hand-type smoke from a party bowl's big load, and Hal can take every iota way down deep and hold his breath forever, so that even his exhalations are no more than slightly pale and sick, sweet-smelling. Total utilization of available resources equals lack of publicly detectable waste. The Academy's tennis court's lungs pump room is underground and accessible only by tunnel. ETA is abundantly, embranchingly, tunneled. This is by design. Plus, one-hitters are small, which is good because, let's face it, anything you use to smoke high-resin dope with is going to stink. A bong is big, and its stink is going to be, like, commensurately big. Plus, you have the foul bong water to deal with. Pipes are smaller and at least portable, but they always come with only a multi-hit party bowl that disperses non-utilized smoke over a wide area. A one-hitter can be wastelessly employed, then allowed to cool, wrapped in two baggies, and then further wrapped and sealed in a Ziploc, and then enclosed in two sport socks, in a gear bag along with the lighter, and eye drops, and mint pellets, and the little film case of dope itself, and it's highly portable and odor-free, and basically totally covert. As far as Hal knows, colleagues Michael Pemulis, Jim Strzok, Bridget C. Boone, Jim Trolch, Ted Schacht, Trevor Axford, and possibly Kyle D. Coyle and Tall Paul Shaw, and remotely, possibly, Franny Unwin, all know Hal gets regularly, covertly high. It's also not impossible that Bernadette Longley knows, actually. And of course, the unpleasant K. Freer always has suspicions of all kinds. And Hal's brother Mario knows a thing or two, but that's it, in terms of public knowledge. But even though Pemulis and Strzok and Boone and Trolch and Axford, and occasionally, in a sort of medicinal and touristic way, Stice and Schacht, all are known to get high also, Hal has actually gotten actively high only with Pemulis, on the rare occasions he's gotten high with anybody else, as in person, which he avoids. He'd forgot. Ortho the Darkness Stice of Partridge, Kansas knows. And Hal's oldest brother, Orin, mysteriously, even long distance, seems to know more than he's coming right out and saying, unless Hal's reading more into some of the phone comments than are there. Hal's mother, Mrs. Avril Incandenza, and her adoptive brother, Dr. Charles Tavis, the current ETA headmaster, both know Hal drinks alcohol sometimes, like on weekend nights with Trolch or maybe Axford, down the hill at clubs on Commonwealth Avenue. The unexamined life has its notorious blind bouncer night every Friday, where they card you on the honor system. Mrs. Avril Incandenza isn't crazy about the idea of Hal drinking, mostly because of the way his father had drunk when alive, and reportedly his father's own father before him in Arizona and California. But Hal's academic precocity, and especially his late competitive success on the junior circuit, make it clear that he's able to handle whatever modest amounts she's pretty sure he consumes. There's no way someone can seriously abuse a substance and perform at top, scholarly, and athletic levels, the ETA psych counselor Dr. Rusk assures her, especially the high-level athletic part. And Avril feels it's important that a concerned but unsmothering single parent know when to let go somewhat and let the two high-functioning of her three sons make their own possible mistakes and learn from their own valid experience, no matter how much the secret worry about mistakes tears her gizzard out. The mothers. And Charles supports whatever personal decisions she makes in conscience about her children. And God knows she'd rather have Hal having a few glasses of beer every so often than absorbing God alone knows what sort of esoteric designer compounds with reptilian Michael Pemulis and trail of slime-leaving James Strzok, both of whom give Avril a howling case of the maternal phantods. And ultimately, she's told doctors Rusk and Tavis, she'd rather have Hal abide in the security of the knowledge that his mother trusts him, that she's trusting and supportive and doesn't judge or gizzard tear or wring her fine hands over his having, for instance, a glass of Canadian ale with friends every now and again, and so works tremendously hard to hide her maternal dread of his possibly ever drinking like James himself or James's father. All so that Hal might enjoy the security of feeling that he can be upfront with her about issues like drinking and not feel he has to hide anything from her under any circumstances. Dr. Tavis and Dolores Rusk have privately discussed the fact that, not least among the phobic stressors Avril suffers so uncomplainingly with, is a black phobic dread of hiding or secrecy in all possible forms with respect to her sons. Avril and CT know nothing about Hal's penchants for high-resin Bob Hope and underground absorption, which fact Hal obviously likes a lot on some level, though he's never given much thought to why. To why he likes it so much. ETA's hilltop grounds are traversable by tunnel. Avril I, for example, who never leaves the grounds anymore, rarely travels above ground, willing to hunch to take the off-tunnels between Headmaster's house and her office next to Charles Tavis's in the Community and Administration Building. A pink-bricked, white-pillared Neo-Georgian thing that Hal's brother Mario says looks like a cube that has swallowed a ball too big for its stomach.
3.
Two sets of elevators and one of stairs run between the lobby, reception area, and administrative offices on ComEd's first floor and the weight room, sauna, and locker shower areas on the sub-level below it. One large tunnel of elephant-colored cement leads from just off the boys' showers to the mammoth laundry room below the west courts, and two smaller tunnels radiate from the sauna area south and east to the sub-basements of the smaller, spherocubular, proto-Georgian buildings, housing classrooms and sub-dormitories B and D. These two basements and smaller tunnels often serve as student storage space and hallways between various prorectors' private rooms.
4.
Then two even smaller tunnels, navigable by any adult willing to assume a kind of knuckle-dragging simian posture, in turn connect each of the sub-basements to the former optical and film development facilities of Leith and Ogilvy, and the late Dr. James O. Incandenza, now deceased, below and just west of the headmaster's house, from which facilities there's also a fair-diametered tunnel that goes straight to the lowest level of the community and administration building. But its functions have gradually changed over 4 years, and it's now too full of exposed wiring and hot water pipes and heating ducts to be really passable. And to the offices of the physical plant, almost directly beneath the center row of ETA outdoor tennis courts, which offices and custodial lounge are in turn connected to ETA's lung storage and pump rooms via a pargeted tunnel hastily constructed by the Testar All-Weather Inflatable Structures Corp., which together with the folks over at the ATHSCME, Industrial Air Displacement Devices, erects and services the inflatable dendrourethane dome, known as the lung, that covers the middle row of courts for the winter indoor season. The crude little rough-sided tunnel between plant and pump is traversable only via all-fours-type crawling and is essentially unknown to staff and administration, popular only with the Academy's smaller kids' tunnel club, as well as with certain adolescents with strong secret incentive to crawl on all fours. The lung storage room is basically impassable from March through November because it's full of intricately folded dendrourethane lung material and dismantled sections of flexible ducting and fan blades, etc. The pump room is right next to it, though you have to crawl back out into the tunnel to get to it. On the engineering diagrams, the pump rooms may be about 20 meters directly beneath the centermost courts in the middle row of courts, and looks like a kind of spider hanging upside down. An unfenestrated oval chamber with 6 man-sized, curved ducts radiating up and out to exit points on the grounds above. And the pump room has 6 radial openings, one for each up-curving duct. 3 2-meter vents with huge turbine-bladed exhaust fans bolted into their grills, and 3 more 2Ms with reversed ATHSCME intake fans that allow air from the ground above to be sucked down and around the room and up into the 3 exhaust vents. The pump room is essentially like a pulmonary organ, or the epicenter of a massive 6-vectored wind tunnel, and when activated roars like a banshee that slammed its hand in a door, though the PR's in full legit operation only when the lung is up, usually November to March. The intake fans pull ground-level winter air down into and around the room and through the 3 exhaust fans and up the outtake ducts into networks of pneumatic tubing in the lung's sides and dome. It's the pressure of the moving air that keeps the fragile lung inflated. When the quartz lung is down and stored, Hal will descend and walk and then hunch his way in to make sure nobody's in the physical plant quarters. Then he'll hunch and crawl to the PR, gear bag in his teeth, and activate just one of the big exhaust fans and get secretly high and exhale palely through its blades into the vent so that any possible odor is blown through an outtake duct and expelled through a grilled hole on the west side of the west courts, a threaded hole with a flange where brisk, white-suited ATHSCME guys will attach some of the lung's arterial pneumatic tubing at some point soon when Stitt et al. On staff decide the real weather has moved past enduring for outdoor tennis. During winter months, when any expelled odor would get ducted up into the lung and hang there conspicuous, Hal mostly goes into a remote sub-dormitory lavatory and climbs onto a toilet in a stall and exhales into the grill of one of the little exhaust fans in the ceiling. But this routine lacks a certain intricate subterranean covert drama. It's another reason why Hal dreads Interdependence Day and the approach of the Whataburger Classic and Thanksgiving and unendurable weather and the erection of the lung. Recreational drugs are more or less traditional at any U.S. secondary school, maybe because of the unprecedented tensions, post-latency, and puberty, and angst, and impending adulthood, etc. to help manage the intra-psychic storms, etc. Since the place's inception, there's always been a certain percentage of the high-caliber adolescent players at ETA who manage their internal weathers chemically. Much of this is good, clean, temporary fun, but a traditionally smaller and harder core set tends to rely on personal chemistry to manage ETA's special demands. Dexedrine or low-volt methadrine.
5.
Before matches, and benzodiazepines to come back down after matches.
6.
With mudslides or blue flames at some understanding Commonwealth Avenue night spot.
7.
Or beers and bongs in some discreet academy corner at night to short-circuit the up-and-down cycle. Mushrooms or X or something from the mild designer class.
8.
Or maybe, occasionally, a little black star.
9.
Whenever there's a match and demand-free weekend, to basically short out the whole motherboard and blow out all the circuits and slowly recover and be almost neurologically reborn and start the gradual cycle all over again. This circular routine, if your basic wiring's okay to begin with, can work surprisingly well throughout adolescence and sometimes into one's, like, early 20s before it starts to creep up on you. But so, some ETAs, not just Hal and Condensa by any means, are involved with recreational substances, is the point. Like who isn't at some life stage in the USA and interdependent regions in these troubled times for the most part? Though a decent percentage of ETA students aren't at all, i.e., involved. Some persons can give themselves away to an ambitious pursuit and have that be all the giving themselves away to something they need to do. Though sometimes this changes as the players get older and the pursuit more stress-fraught. American experience seems to suggest that people are virtually unlimited in their need to give themselves away on various levels. Some just prefer to do it in secret. An enrolled student-athlete's use of alcohol or illicit chemicals is cause for immediate expulsion, according to ETA's admissions catalog. But the ETA staff tends to have a lot more important stuff on its plate than policing kids who've already given themselves away to an ambitious competitive pursuit. The administrative attitude under first James Incandenza and then Charles Tavis is like, why would anybody who wanted to compromise his faculties chemically even come here to ETA, where the whole point is to stress and stretch your faculties along multiple vectors?
10.
And since it's the alumni pro-rectors who have the most direct supervisory contact with the kids, and since most of the pro-rectors themselves are depressed or traumatized about not making it into the show and having to come back to ETA and live in decent but subterranean rooms off the tunnels and work as assistant coaches and teach laughable elective classes, which is what the 8 ETA pro-rectors do when they're not off playing satellite tournaments or trying to make it through the qualifying rounds of some serious money event, and so they're morose and low on morale and feel bad about themselves often, as a rule, and so, also not all that surprisingly, tend to get high now and then themselves, though in a less covert or exuberant fashion than the hardcore students' chemical cadre. But so, given all this, it's not hard to see why internal drug enforcement at ETA tends to be flaccid. The other nice thing about the pump room is the way it's connected by tunnel to the pro-rector's rows of housing units, which means men's rooms, which means Hal can crawl, hunch, and tiptoe into an unoccupied men's room and brush his teeth with his portable Oral-B and wash his face and apply eye drops and Old Spice and a plug of wintergreen Kodiak and then saunter back to the sauna area and ascend to ground level, looking and smelling right as rain. Because when he gets high, he develops a powerful obsession with having nobody, not even the neurochemical cadre, know he's high. This obsession is almost irresistible in its force. The amount of organization and toiletry lugging he has to do to get secretly high in front of a subterranean outtake vent in the pre-supper gap would make a lesser man quail. Hal has no idea why this is, or whence this obsession, with the secrecy of it. He broods on it abstractly at times, when high. This no-one-must-know thing. It's not fear per se, fear of discovery. Beyond that, it all gets too abstract and twined up to lead to anything, Hal's brooding. Like most North Americans of his generation, Hal tends to know way less about why he feels certain ways about the objects and pursuits he's devoted to than he does about the objects and pursuits themselves. It's hard to say for sure whether this is even exceptionally bad, this tendency. At 0015 hours, the 2nd of April, the medical attaché's wife is just leaving the Mount Auburn Total Fitness Center, having played 5 6-game pro sets in her little Mideast diplomatic wife tennis circles weekly round robin, then hung around the special silver key members lounge with the other ladies, unwrapping her face and hair and playing Nargis and all smoking kiff and making extremely delicate and oblique fun of their husbands' sexual idiosyncrasies, laughing softly with their hands over their mouths.
11.
The medical attaché at their apartment is still viewing the unlabeled cartridge, which he has rewound to the beginning several times, and then configured for a recursive loop. He sits there, attached to a congealed supper, watching, at 0020 hours, having now wet both his pants and the special recliner. 18 in May, Mario and Cadenza's designated function around Enfield Tennis Academy is filmic. Sometimes during AM drills or PM matches, he'll be assigned by Coach Stitt et al. To set up an old camcorder, or whatever video stuff's to hand, on a tripod and record a certain area of court, videotaping different kids' strokes, footwork, certain ticks and hitches and serves or running volleys, so the staff can show the tapes to the kids instructionally, letting the kids see on the screen exactly what a coach or pro rector's talking about. The reason being, it's a lot easier to fix something if you can see it. Autumn, year of dairy products from the American heartland. Drug addicts, driven to crime, to finance their drug addiction, are not often inclined toward violent crime. Violence requires all different kinds of energy, and most drug addicts like to expend their energy not on their professional crime, but on what their professional crime lets them afford. Drug addicts are often burglars, therefore. One reason why the home of someone whose home has been burglarized feels violated and unclean is that there have probably been drug addicts in there. Don Gately was a 27-year-old oral narcotics addict, favoring Demerol and Toluene.
12.
And a more or less professional burglar. And he was, himself, unclean and violated. But he was a gifted burglar when he burgled, though the size of a young dinosaur, with a massive and almost perfectly square head he used to amuse his friends when drunk by letting them open and close elevator doors on, he was, at his professional zenith, smart, sneaky, quiet, quick, possessed of good taste and reliable transportation, with a kind of ferocious jolliness in his attitude toward his livelihood. As an active drug addict, Gately was distinguished by his ferocious and jolly elan. He kept his big square chin up and his smile wide, but he bowed neither toward nor away from any man. He took zero in the way of shit and was a cheery but implacable exponent of the don't get mad, get even school. Like, for instance, once, after he'd done a really unpleasant 3-month bit in Revere holding on nothing more than a remorseless North Shore assistant district attorney's circumstantial suspicion, finally getting out after 92 days when his PD got the charges dismissed on a right to speedy brief, Gately and a trusted associate paid a semi-professional visit to the private home of this assistant DA, whose zeal and warrant had cost Gately a nasty impromptu detox on the floor of his little holding cell.
13.
Also a believer in the revenge is tastier chilled dictum, Gately had waited patiently until the Eye on People section of the Globe mentioned the ADA and his wife's presence at some celebrity charity sailing thing out in Marblehead. Gately and the associate went that night to the ADA's private home in the upscale Wonderland Valley section of Revere, killed the power to the home with a straight shunt in the meter's inflow, then clipped just the ground wire on the home's pricey HBT alarm, so that the alarm would sound after 10 or so minutes and create the impression that the perps had somehow bungled the alarm and been scared off in the middle of the act. Later that night, when Revere's and Marblehead's finest summoned them home, the ADA and his wife found themselves minus a coin collection and two antique shotguns and nothing more. Quite a few other valuables were stacked on the floor of the living room off the foyer, like the perps hadn't had time to get them out of the house. Everything else in the burglarized home looked undisturbed. The ADA was a jaded pro. He walked around touching the brim of his hat and reconstructed probable events.
14.
The perps looked like they'd bungled, disabling the alarm all the way, and had got scared off by the thing's siren when the alarm's pricey HBT alternate ground kicked in at 300 volts. The ADA soothed his wife's sense of violation and uncleanliness. He calmly insisted on sleeping there in their home that very night. No hotel. It was like crucial to get right back on the emotional horse in cases like this, he insisted. And then the next day, the ADA worked out the insurance and reported the shotguns to a buddy at ATF, and his wife calmed down, and life went on.
15.
About a month later, an envelope arrived in the ADA's home's exquisite wrought iron mailbox. In the envelope were a standard American Dental Association glossy brochure on the importance of daily oral hygiene, available at like any dentist's office anywhere, and two high-pixel Polaroid snapshots, one of Big Don Gately and one of his associate, each in a Halloween mask, denoting a clown's great good professional cheer, each with his pants down and bent over, and each with the enhanced focus handle of one of the couple's toothbrushes protruding from his bottom. Don Gately had sense enough never to work the North Shore again after that. But he ended up in hideous trouble anyway, ADA-wise. It was either bad luck or kismet or so forth. It was because of a cold, a plain old human rhinovirus. And not even Don Gately's cold is what made him finally stop and question his kismet. The thing started out looking like tit on a tray, burglary-wise. A beautiful neo-Georgian home in a wildly upscale part of Brookline was set nicely back from an unlit pseudo-rural road, had a chintzy Centrico alarm system that fed, idiotically enough, on a whole separate 330-volt AC 90-hertz cable with its own meter. Didn't seem to be on anything like a regular PM patrol route, and had, at its rear, flimsily tasteful French doors, surrounded by dense and thorn-free, deciduous shrubbery, and blocked off from the garage's halogen floods by a private EWD-issue upscale dumpster. It was, in short, a real cocktease of a home, burglary-wise, for a drug addict. And Don Gately straight-shunted the alarm's meter and, with an associate, broke and entered and crept around on huge cat feet.
16.
Except, unfortunately, the owner of the house turned out to be still home, even though both of his cars and the rest of his family were gone. The little guy was asleep, sick in bed upstairs, in acetate pajamas, with a hot water bottle on his chest, and half a glass of OJ, and a bottle of NyQuil, and a foreign book and copies of International Affairs and Interdependent Affairs, and a pair of thick specs, and an industrial-sized box of Kleenex on the bedside table, and an empty vaporizer barely humming at the foot of the bed. And the guy was, to say the least, nonplussed, to wake up and see high-filter flashlights crisscrossing over the unlit bedroom walls and bureau, antique